on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
I mean, they can't dig fast enough at Karahan Tepe. Yeah, I mean, yeah. They're uncovering so much so quickly, right, that I'm sure some will say, you know, well, slow down, you might miss something. Yeah. But no, they're doing it meticulously. It's the good work of Dr. Necmi Karol of the University of Istanbul. And at Göbekli Tepe, they did down tools for quite a few years, mm-hmm, saying that they were going to leave it for a few generations because, you know, in the generation to come, the techniques of archaeology will be better. That's a fair statement. But the trouble is, we want to know what's going on. This is right, our heritage, our right, human heritage here. This is not just, you know, some domestic site from the Bronze Age or something. You know, this will tell us who we are and where we came from, possibly, right, you know, and help us direct us into the future.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author Andrew Collins to discuss his book, Karahan Tepe, Civilization of the Anunnaki and the Cosmic Origins of the Serpent of Eden. Andrew delves into the significance of Karahan Tepe and its connection with other ancient sites like Göbekli Tepe. He discusses the site's stone enclosures featuring snake imagery, its alignment with celestial events, and the shamanic practices involving snakes and cosmic beliefs. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Andrew Collins is a science and history writer who has investigated the true origins of human civilization for more than 30 years. He is the co-discoverer of a massive cave complex beneath the Giza Plateau, now known as Collins Cave. He is the author of several books, including Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods, and the Cygnus Key. He joins me today to discuss his latest book, Karahan Tepe. Andrew, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you for inviting me. Plenty to talk about. So let's start with maybe where all this began, I think. You know, what's, yes, Karahan Tepe and why are we talking about it? Well, Karahan Tepe is arguably the most exciting archaeological discovery of the 21st century. And I'm not including Göbekli Tepe there because obviously that was discovered in the late 20th century. And what it is a series of stone enclosures. Some of them are actually cut directly out of the bedrock, including one which we call the Pillar Shrine, which is 11,000 years old, that has 10 pillars carved directly out of the rock within this sort of, you know, area that's been dropped down into the rock itself, plus an 11th one that's been brought in. And on the side wall, on the side of the actual hill, this limestone hill called Karahan Tepe, there's this huge human head that's about three times the size of a normal head that's on the end of a long serpentine neck, looking like something out of Beetlejuice, basically. And, you know, and there are serpents everywhere. They're on the sides of stones. They're on the sides of benches. They're incised, you know, on the floor, you know, curved lines and things like that. It's quite clear that the snake was something that was incredibly important to them. And, you know, my interest is what was going on here as much as 11,000 years ago. I first went there 20 years ago in 2004. And no, there was no excavations had taken place at that time. Over the years, I investigated, in theory, every corner of that place and, you know, the surrounding hills as well. And then in 2018, a survey was carried out by the University of Istanbul in readiness for excavations the following year. And they began, and everything obviously went quiet for over 2 years. And then suddenly they revealed what they discovered. And it was essentially a lost city, really. You know, I mean, I call it the lost city of the Anunnaki for reasons which we can go into. But it's just extraordinary. And it begs the question of what was going on there. I mean, most people by now know about Göbekli Tepe, which is the sister site of Karahan. They're about 25 miles apart from each other. And clearly you've got a series of stone circles with T-shaped pillars in, you know, set in spokes of a wheel that focus around two huge, great central monoliths. They're anthropomorphic in nature, in the sense that they've got, relief arms and clothes, like the hems of some kind of garment. They've got belts and things like this. There are glyphs all over the place. Plus, there are carvings of all types of animals of the ancient world, on these T pillars, everything from leopards to boars to bovines to spiders, scorpions, lots of birds. There's vultures, there's wader birds, there's toads, all sorts of stuff. So, what's going on at these places? And when I first saw both Karahan Tepe and Göbekli Tepe 20 years ago, my interest was what was going on in the brains of these people. I mean, others might say, well, how did they make it? How did they create these structures? But for me, I'm interested in what's going on up here, what's going on in their minds, what they believed, what their practices were, what their cosmology, their cosmogony might have been like. So the book that has just come out, Karahan Tepe, Civilization, the Anunnaki, etc., that is essentially my statement at the moment, but it's not the first statement I've made. The first book I wrote was on this subject, was in 1996. It was called From the Ashes of Angels. And this basically said that in this area, the area we're talking about is southeastern Anatolia, modern day Turkey. This was the cradle of civilization. In biblical tradition, it was also the Garden of Eden or the Land of Eden, where the four rivers of paradise took their rise. They can be quite easily named as the Tigris, the Euphrates, the Greater Zab, and also the Arts River. And all of them rise somewhere in the area of eastern Turkey. So we know we're in the right area for what the book of Genesis essentially says. Adam and Eve kick-started it all. The serpent came along and told them to eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. They did so. They realized they were naked. They realized, that they lost their innocence. They were thrown out of there by God and tilled the land and created the first agriculture. And in stories in the very area of both Göbekli Tepe and Karahan Tepe, it said that Adam and Eve went on to the surrounding plain, known as the Haran Plain, and they grew the first wheat, which I find incredible in the knowledge that we now know that the earliest wheat in the world, certainly domesticated wheat, comes from a wild variety that grows within sight of Göbekli Tepe. In fact, over 60 different varieties that we use today to create bread, beer, pasta, cakes, etc., all derive from the DNA of this wild form grown within sight of both Göbekli Tepe and Karahan Tepe. So I find that, quite extraordinary. But as I said, it's a case of, what were these people doing really? So that's what the book's about.
Yeah, thank you for that. I just wanted to say I found the book interesting. I have taught the Western religious tradition for quite a while, and I always take a historical approach. And I began mentioning Göbekli Tepe at the very beginning, and I would always point out to students that our understanding and knowledge of that area is still sort of unfolding. And I say, whatever I tell you, this is based on the most current understanding, but one archaeological discovery can change everything pretty quickly. And so, reading the book, there's definitely a connection with the snake and the Eden story. And if I understand this correctly, when you're looking at Karahan Tepe, there are a couple of different parts of the, I don't know what to call it, the city, the find, where there's a pillar shrine, and that you argue is in the shape of a head, and there's a channel that leads up to it. So it's sort of a snake figure. And that is representative in many ways of the Milky Way galaxy that was seen as a snake that encircled the world. And in particular, the dark rift within the Milky Way gives this sense of a snake's head.
That's
And
correct.
okay. And also, I'm just making sure I'm getting everything that you wrote correctly here, that you were sort of arguing, and I do want to go into how this imagery flows into other mythologies as well. But that you argue that there was a sort of shamanic activity going on at Karahantepe, and that they were communicating in a sense with the snake of the Milky Way galaxy.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we have to differentiate between communications with real intelligences and what these people might have been getting up to and what they believe themselves. I mean, obviously, we can't say for sure whether they were communicating with a genuine, you know, entity of a cosmic nature, but we can certainly look at the possibility that that's what they believed that they were doing. And I mean, all of this came about because of this mass amount of snake imagery. And I started immediately, I saw an overhead image of Karahan to try and work out the orientations of the structures. And one of them, which we call the pit shrine, which is structure AA, which is this sort of like flat bedrock interior. And it's got this huge dropped area in the center that goes down probably about 8 to 10 feet. And there's no obvious way of accessing it. It's got an alcove within it. And I would say it's very clearly for some kind of ritual practice. I looked at all of this and I realized that it was aligned to sunset at the time of the summer solstice in around 9000 BC, which is interesting because this would make it arguably one of the earliest aligned monuments in the world, if not the oldest. But as I was looking at the sky program, you know, I sort of clicked forward a couple of hours just to see what would happen once it got dark. And immediately it got dark, as you looked at exactly the same spot where the sun had disappeared at the time of the solstice, the Milky Way would be towering upwards directly with the dark rift right there up to the northern opening, which is marked by the stars of the constellation of Cygnus, in particular the star Deneb, which is the brightest of the group. But what's so interesting is that the area at the base where you'd be looking at the horizon, just setting at that moment, because obviously this also would be setting at that time, would be the galactic bulge. Now, the galactic bulge is the center of our own Milky Way galaxy. And today, we hardly ever see it. But in the past, you know, the suggestion is that it would have been much brighter, almost like a light bulb in the sky. And the ancients would have been attracted to it. And it's also marked by the stars of Scorpius as well, which is seen both as a scorpion and a snake in many different ancient cultures. And you've also got another constellation there called Ophiuchus, which is the serpent bearer, or the serpent holder, or the snake charmer, who holds a snake called Serpens, which is made up of stars. And right next to it, of course, is Sagittarius. And Sagittarius is where you actually have, in the first degree of Sagittarius, galactic center. So all of this is together, and all of this is setting as you look at it on the horizon. So, you know, there would be a moment, you know, as it got dark, where all of this would be there just before it sets down. And I started to look at what the galactic bulge might have meant to these people. And what I found is that there were various accounts of ancient cultures. I mean, the Maya, for instance, of seeing the galactic bulge as the head of a snake which quite clearly was being seen as the Milky Way itself. Now, whether it was the whole of the Milky Way or half the Milky Way is debatable. I mean, I think the Maya probably saw it as half the Milky Way, because the other end of the, you know, the place where Sagittarius and Scorpius is where one point where the sun, the ecliptic, crosses the Milky Way. At the other end, you've got, you know, Pleiades, Orion, Gemini, that sort of area. It's another sort of sky gate. And the tail of this snake, a rattlesnake in the case of the Maya, is there. So clearly, you know, it was half the sky for them. You know, in other words, it arched over from one side to the other. But it would seem that in other cultures, in Akkadian, in the Norse mythology, in Vedic tradition, and possibly in North American tradition as well, it was the entire Milky Way. But the head would seem to have been associated very strongly with the area of Sagittarius, Scorpius, and Ophiuchus. So I began to look at the possibility that these people at Corahan, as much as 11,000 years ago, were looking at a prototype form of a belief system that was pretty universal in much later times, many thousands of years later. And that their main interest was the galactic bulge, which would have been the head of this creature. Why the head? Well, because it's pretty damn well established that the early Neolithic in Anatolia believed that the soul resided in the head or the skull. You see various images at places like Çatalhöyük in southern central Turkey, which is a pottery Neolithic site that goes back about 7,000 BC, and also Göbekli Tepe itself, of vultures in association with heads of humans, basically, whether they're completely abstract, just like a ball, or whether they are more skull-like with little eyes and a mouth. And this shows vultures in association with the soul of the dead. The vultures are acting as psychopomps, you know, soul carriers. In other words, they are either protecting, guiding, or carrying the soul from one world to the next. So, and also, it seems pretty certain that in the early Neolithic, in the Levant and in Anatolia, that they removed the heads of individuals before they disposed of the body. And there's evidence that the disposing of it meant that they would place the bodies, the cadavers, on high points, and the vultures would come down and pick them clean. What we call today sky burial, which we know still takes place on places like the Tibetan plateau. I mean, just look up sky burial Tibet and some very gruesome images will appear on your screen. But in the past, they were doing this, but the head would be kept aside because that would be cleaned up, possibly decorated and stored and used both as a point of contact with the deceased and, you know, their ancestral line, one assumes, but also it was still felt that the skull itself was a seat of power. So in other words, if you collected skulls, you know, you could collect all of that power. I mean, there's a site near Göbekli Tepe called Çayönü or Çayönü Tepesi, which is another pre-pottery Neolithic site. It's actually near the city of Diyarbakır. And there's a quite gruesome building there called the Skull Building. And not only have they found evidence of human blood on a massive great slab that was found just outside of this really well-constructed building, but they found literally hundreds of human skulls actually beneath the building itself. And of course, yeah, this all adds up to something, you know, particularly gruesome happening there, but I'm not sure that it's as gruesome as we think it is, because I think what was going on is that when a person died, their heads were being chopped off. That's where the blood comes from. The skull was then being, you know, kept to one side. The body was then be placed out for the vultures to peck, and the bones would presumably have been, you know, picked up afterwards and placed in what's known as a secondary burial. So, you know, this is what I think is going on. So in other words, the fact that these people at Corahan may well have been focusing on the head of this cosmic serpent makes absolute sense, because that's where they would see the soul of it, the spirit of it. And if you look at the stars of Scorpius in relationship to the galactic bulge, it almost looks like a trail of stars coming out of the mouth of this cosmic serpent. So what I interpret that as is almost like the active spirit of that Milky Way serpent. But also you could even see it as the tongue. And of course, we need tongues to speak. So the idea that, you know, this represents a tongue, and the fact that it's wagging and, you know, moving about is almost symbolic of the spirit of this, you know, this cosmic serpent, you know, speaking to them. And you talked about the pillar shrine actually being the head. Well, it's the head of a snake. And this is an interesting story, because a couple of years ago, I was out in Turkey. We'd just been to Korahan Tepe. And what we do in our tours is, you know, to tell people as much as they need to know and then throw it over to them and say, well, look, you know, you're an engineer, you're a geologist, you're a builder, you're a three thinker, you're a painter. What do you think about these sites? And One lady, put up a hand and said, "Do you think that the pillar shrine, as you look down onto it from its overhead profile, could have been a human sperm, complete with a tail, because you have this long, deep cut groove going away from it that highlights a raised area that almost looks like a sort of tail?" And I thought about it for a moment, and I then just said, "Nah, it can't be." I said, "These people didn't have microscopes. It could have been intuitive, of course, but then, as I was saying this, I thought, wait a minute, what if it's not a sperm? What if it's an actual snake? What if the actual shrine is the head of a snake?" So I overlaid the head of a local indigenous snake, which was the Anatolian meadow viper, which at the time I didn't even know was known about by the people at Corihan. Now I know it is, because they found a number of bones of this particular species in a new enclosure that they've only just uncovered. But I didn't know this a couple of years ago, and it fitted perfectly. And once you fit that head, the head of the snake over the top of that shrine, you can just see the neck and the body coming away from it. It's so plain that it becomes impossible to undo that connection. But of course, then you have to ask yourself, why would you want to go into the head of a snake? Well, the only way you would get into that snake, particularly if that structure had a roof, which we think it did, is through this tiny little porthole at one end, which faces into this big enclosure, which we call the Great Ellipse, its structure AD. And quite literally, you'd have to sort of pull your way through this little tiny porthole, which is in this slim, like, wall of rock that they've actually left in place for this purpose. It's the only way you can get into this shrine. And so you would slip down into that, and you would now be in the mouth of a snake. So what's going to go on then? Well, firstly, these pillars inside it, it's possible that they are abstract teeth, the fangs of the snake itself. It's possible. But I think more importantly, once you're inside it, I think that the idea is to believe that you're being consumed or even eaten by that snake. And again, why would you do that? To become a part of it, almost to become a part of what we'd call its DNA, to be digested by it. Because I think in doing so, you become at one with its celestial counterpart. In other words, this snake, which is a case of as above, so below, the two become as one, so that the mind melts or melds with this cosmic version of itself. And one assumes that all this was going on at particular nights. The summer solstice, obviously, we found that alignment. But my good friend and colleagues, Hugh Newman and J.J. Ainsworth, discovered that there was a midwinter alignment in connection with that huge giant head in the pillar shrine, that just after sunrise at the time of the winter solstice, and it still does it now, but it would have been better in the past, the sun would come right the way across the Great Ellipse, straight through the porthole stone, and illuminate that head for about 40 minutes. And I mean, I've witnessed it. I've sat opposite and witnessed it on a couple of occasions, and it is dramatic. And the sun would not have gone anywhere else in the actual shrine if there'd been a roof on it. So, of course, if there had been a roof, it would have been dark anyway in there. So it would have made it, very dramatic. So we know that the solstice seemed to be incredibly important to these people. And the night before the solstice would seem to have been a very important night. And I tell you for why, because just last year on the top of Corihan Tepe, so the ones I've been talking about so far are what I'd call now the lower level, on the actual top of the hill, they've now uncovered this massive stone enclosure. It has this huge statue of a giant, literally, that's seated with a massive human head. Again, very much like the other giant head in the pillar shrine. And if he stood up, he'd probably be about 9 feet tall, essentially. There's a vulture there, there's an altar, there's a porthole stone, a circular porthole stone with a hole. And it's quite clear that this enclosure is aligned to a local hill where there's a farm. You can quite clearly see it. And that makes it easy to try and understand the azimuth alignment. And what I found here is that it's aligned perfectly to the rising of a star called Deneb in the constellation of Cygnus, the celestial bird and the celestial vulture, as it was in the area of the Near East, Anatolia, and neighboring Armenia. And that's amazing in itself. I mean, particularly as this enclosure is 11,000 years old. However, what's more important is that as that happens, the whole of the Milky Way and the dark rift in it would be rising with it, perfectly horizontal, going all the way round to the east, where the galactic bulge would be rising at the same time, and the stars of Scorpius. And that's the exact alignment of this great ellipse. At the back of it, you have these stone thrones, as I call them, actually cut out of the bedrock, where clearly people would have sat. And between them, there are these huge rock-cut buttresses that would have acted as like rock-cut forms of the T-pillars. And if you'd have been sitting on there and you'd have been able to look out or certainly be aware of what was going on the eastern horizon, you would have looked directly at the head of that cosmic serpent rising up. At the same time, on the top of it, that Deneb would have been rising as well. The whole thing would have been just this beautiful rising up of the cosmic serpent out of the horizon itself. So all of this tells us that you're dealing with a culture that wanted to synchronize with the celestial events, not just the sun, quite possibly the moon, we've talked about that, but also the Milky Way and prominent stars that are actually positioned on the Milky Way.
Yeah. Thank you for all of that. There's something I want to get to that you didn't talk about in the book, but I wanted to point out to you, but I want to kind of get us there first. And one of the things that you talk about in the book, you look at some of these examples of later periods in later traditions where snakes appear. And there are divine beings that fight the snake, as it were. So we have the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation myth with Marduk and the sea serpent monster Tiamat.
Yeah.
In the Greek tradition, there is Apollo and Typhon. And
Absolutely.
That's connected to the oracle at Delphi.
Which I go into.
Yes.
In
yeah.
Chapters, of course. Yeah, I mean, so if you can throw yourself back to Karahan 11,000 years ago, what would you see? And I get the feeling, you know, from everything that we've been talking about and more on what we know about shamanic practices, that the idea was not just to communicate with this cosmic serpent, but to actually allow it to enter inside you, to, you know, for it to quite literally possess the individuals. There are religious cults around the world to this day that snakes, you know, are believed to enter inside. And when that takes place and possession occurs, the people will quite literally fall on the ground and writhe around like a snake, believing that they're actually a snake. This happens today. I mean, certainly in Haiti, for instance, obviously in the Vodun tradition. In Thailand, I talk about a snake cult there where it goes on to this day. So, you know, if it's going on today, that the chances are this was going on 11,000 years ago. And I say that if you're going from the Great Ellipse into the Pillar Shrine, you have to quite literally slither through it like a snake to actually do it. So I think that that was deliberate. So they're evoking the snake into them. And I think what happens is that just like with the oracle at Delphi, the shaman or shamaness would, you know, would quite literally start speaking in tongues, as it were, some kind of you know, shamanic language that perhaps, you know, waiting attendants would be able to understand and interpret. Maybe some of it was in their language. And this would provide them with information, whether it be knowledge, wisdom, perhaps knowledge to do with their fate and destiny, maybe even technologies and innovation. We don't know. And that this was something that progressed and advanced the Tashtepala culture. That's the name that the archaeologists, you know, now use for this pre-pottery Neolithic world in southeastern Anatolia. And it would have been similar to what was going on at the Delphic Oracle. Because let's look at that for a second. I mean, the stories are that the Pythia, the priestess, also known as the oracle, would sit on a tripod seat above a fissure in the rock, and that the fumes of a dead serpent, Typhon, the very one that you mentioned, would rise up and intoxicate them, put them into a trance, and this would allow Apollo to possess them and to speak through them. And this could define the fate, the destiny of kings, of kingdoms, or even the gods themselves. So it was incredibly powerful. And obviously, you know, whatever was going on, people believed it was actually a real thing. But here's the thing. The way that Apollo would seem to appear to these people in a prophetic manner and possess them was not as the nice sun god. It was as a snake. And I show various examples there where it was fully believed that the manner that Apollo appears to people is as a snake. And I think what you're seeing here is the remnants of a much earlier cult that involved, you know, some kind of serpent that at a much later date, you know, the religion of Apollo came along and took over, you know, symbolically slew the serpent that was already the genius loci of the oracle, Delphi, and replaced it with Apollo himself. I think that that's what we're seeing here. So in other words, what was going on at Delphi was probably similar to what was going on at Korahan Tepe.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And it's one of the things that I find fascinating about all of this is that there's connections between a lot of these traditions. And it gets to, I think, the Anunnaki, because one, and I want to make clear, you are not taking a position that's very popular that these are space beings, but rather they come from the Russian steppe lands, probably around 40,000 BCE.
That's probably oversimplifying it, because, I mean, firstly, I'm not a big fan of Zachariah Sitchin and, you know, his suggestion that the Anunnaki were space beings. And I mean, quite clearly before he came along, not many people, I don't think, probably believed that or even knew anything about that subject. No, what I show, and you know, you can do this quite succinctly, is that the Anunnaki were the builder gods of the Mesopotamian civilizations, and they were said to have given us irrigation. They were said to have helped us build the first cities. They gave us animal husbandry. They gave us agriculture. So all the rudiments of civilization here. And it was Klaus Schmidt, the discoverer of Göbekli Tepe, in his wonderful book that he wrote on Göbekli Tepe that was published in 2012, that actually suggested that the Sumerian form of the Anunnaki, which is the Anunna, which basically means, I mean, an Anunnaki means that, you know, is generally interpreted as the gods of heaven and earth, or words to that effect. But that's a very late form of the name. It was originally Anunna, or even Anna was the original form. And this essentially meant possessive of the sky, basically, which you can sort of play around with and even simplify to the sky people. Now, of course, followers of Zachariah Sitchin will say, great, that proves what we're saying, that these are space beings. But I don't think so. I think what's being said here is that these people have knowledge of the sky. Right. You know, in other words, the movement of the sun, the moon, the celestial bodies, you know, possibly even what we'd call today astrology, the understanding of astrology, probably eclipses, and that it was this that they brought to the table. So in other words, you know, these are the people that have knowledge of the sky. I think that's what it means. And, you know, An or Anu is the name of the sky in Sumerian, as it is in various languages going all the way back into the area of Siberia, Mongolia, that Altaic region. And Anu was seen personified as a deity. The sky was seen as a deity, just like it is in many different, you know, religions, particularly in the Eurasian continent.
Yeah, they're the ancestors in many ways, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is it. And what Klaus Schmidt said was that the T-pillars that we see may well be memorializing, the founders or those that were seen to be the precursors or the founders of, what we today call the Tash Tepala movement. And I think he's right. I think he's absolutely correct. And when we look at that massive statue that was just uncovered at Corraham, which obviously I do feature in the book, I mean, are we looking upon the face of an Anuna or an Anunnaki here? I suggest that the answer could well be yes. And as to why it's so big, is that there are very clear legends and stories, particularly from Hebrew myth and legend, that those that gave us the rudiments of civilization were the watchers who came upon the mortal, women who gave birth to giant babies called Nephilim. Obviously, we know them from the Old Testament. And that, they gave us the rudiments of civilization. And what I say in From the Ashes of Angels and other books is that they seem to be a memory of the prime movers, a shamanic elite, birdmen, vulture shamans who came into the midst of communities that already existed in these regions and essentially said, work with us and, bad things won't happen. But that includes, we now know, the construction of these incredible stone, circles, with all these stones and whatever, which I think were constructed for easy access into the sky world at a time that was immediately after the so-called Younger Dryas event, which was a 1200-year period of like a mini ice age, which many now believe, as you probably know, was triggered by some kind of cosmic event, possibly fragments of a comet that came into the atmosphere, broke up even further, peppered the entire northern hemisphere, creating mass wildfires, eating up huge areas of the biomass, creating a period of darkness and dropping the temperatures in various different ways, which triggered this ice age. Now, coming off the end of this, when suddenly everything all changes again back to a more, temperate climate, people would still have been worried that this sort of thing was going to happen again. And these people would never have had, psychiatrists to go and see. But they did have the shamans. The shamans, their role has always been, to get rid of illnesses, whether they be physical or whether they be mental. And what I think is that a certain group came into their midst. I do believe that they did originate somewhere on the Eurasian steppe, and that their journey, or certainly the journey of their ancestors, had begun as far east as Mongolia and Siberia, something that archaeologists are also now coming to accept is the roots of the Göbekli Tepe culture. And they took advantage of the situation, quite literally. I don't think they were necessarily the people that were building it. I think that the local people were building it, and they consisted of probably three, four different cultures meeting in southeastern Anatolia. I think some of them were coming in from the west and were probably linked to the Aegean, where we know there were seafaring cultures who were going to places like Cyprus as much as 12,000 years ago, en masse. So they must have had sea-going vessels. Others were probably coming down from the mountains of the Zagros, the so-called Zazian peoples. There were other peoples coming up from the Levant, the Natufians, whose settlements were as far south as Egypt, at places like Helwan. It would seem that there was an incredibly advanced settlement in Egypt that had direct or indirect communication with places like, Göbekli Tepe as much as 11,000 years ago. We know that from the matching stone tools that are discovered at both of these different sites.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think the ancient world was far more complex than what we actually think. Going on to the, or focusing a little bit on this Younger Dryas, if I understand correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, there's this period where I think it's when the Earth is, or the Sun is directly, I want to say sort of conjunct, I don't know if that's the appropriate way of saying it, with the galactic center. And that seems to mark these cataclysmic events. Is that correct?
I mean, whether this is by coincidence or not, it's a fact. I mean, obviously there was a lot of, a lot of publicity in 2012 about the end of the Mayan calendar or the long count and how it synchronized with the winter solstice in that year. And the idea was that the sun is moving closer and closer to, the center of the Dark Rift, in the area that the galactic center is located, and that all of this synchronized on the 21st of December 2012. Well, firstly, that's not quite the case, because, this is a very slow movement that you can say is a process lasting anything up to 100 years, basically. I mean, the only reason why it was promoted that this was all happening in 2012 is because of the end of the Mayan calendar. But if you want to go back one half of a precessional cycle of 26,000 years, it takes you roughly to about 10,800 BC, which is precisely the date that's now being given for this Younger Dryas trigger event. And I mean, here's the thing, we obviously don't know that if this did generally happen, that what the people would have blamed, they could have blamed, alignments in the sky for this actually taking place. I mean, this could even have been something that that was recurring. Maybe they had a memory of a much earlier cataclysm that also synchronized with a particular, galactic alignment, if you like. So that you've got that. Now, what's so interesting is that this was a time when the galactic center, quite clearly, with its connection with Scorpius, was perfectly aligned, with the solstice at the time of the summer solstice. Now it's at the winter solstice. So obviously half a cycle earlier, which is the last time the synchronization took place, it was at the time of the summer solstice. And at that time, you've got, obviously Scorpio and, lined up with it. And there was a guy by the name of Paul Levine, quite a very clever man, who wrote, a series of books about what this cataclysm could have been. This was before a lot of the Younger Dryas material came out to do with the comet. And he said that he thought it was like some kind of gravitational wave from the center of our Milky Way galaxy, pulsed out probably by the supermassive black hole, which is Sagittarius A star, as it's known. And he felt that this, this ripple, caused and triggered events that had an effect down here. But what he pointed out, and I think is very, very interesting, is that galactic center is very close to the sting of the tail of the stars of Scorpius in its form as a scorpion. Now, I know we've talked about it being a snake as well, but I don't think that's a problem, because, different people are going to have different beliefs in the actual world. Some are going to see it as a scorpion, some are going to see it as a snake. And even if those people come together, it's not necessarily going to, mean that one is a dominant idea over the other. Maybe it would be, but, there are different ideas, as we know. So and he said that he found it too coincidental that the absolute point of the sting, was exactly, coinciding with galactic center at the same time that this cataclysm event. In fact, it's actually even more accurate now than what he suggested when he was writing about this back in what the 19 no 2000s in the 2000s. Sadly, he's no longer with us. But so yeah, I mean, these are sky figures that seem to have a story in their own right relating to what has gone on in the past. And I do believe that the Younger Dryas was triggered by some kind of cataclysm. And the most obvious answer is that it was comet fragments, probably from comet Encke or Encke, which comes around, every few thousand years. In fact, I think the next time that we coincide with its more denser trail of meteorites is in 2032, but they've already had a look at that, and they don't think there's anything too big in there that's going to worry us that much. But it is a possibility, and we actually go through that trail of meteorites that were created by the breakup of comet Encke twice a year, in the Taurids, I think, in what, May, and then is it, I can't remember what they're called now, Scorpions, I suppose, in this time of year. So we go through it twice a year anyway. But generally, we only go through a sort of, a field that has very small meteorites. So that's why we only see, small ones crossing through the skies at these times. But, definitely. And also, if you want to look at something like the Tunguska event of 1908, that was another time that it coincided with us going through this trial of Comet Encke. So clearly that's a good possible candidate for what caused that back then.
Right. So the cosmic center is connected with this cataclysmic event, but isn't it also connected, and I could be wrong, so please correct me, with the sense of creation in a way?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I do think that the ancients saw this area of the sky as the point of creation. Now, they couldn't possibly have known about galactic center, not in theory.
Right.
Maybe intuitively they knew that that area of the sky did relate to creation, and we certainly know that there are many, cosmogenic myths that talk about an egg with a serpent,
right,
and the serpent caused the egg to split apart, and it's, and its interior becomes the physical world. It becomes the vault of heaven. It's obviously there in Gnostic tradition. It's there in Pelasgian tradition within, the Greek ancient world. It's there clearly in other parts of the world. I mean, that have sort of at least fragments of this type of story, which obviously then brings us into the whole concept of Gnosticism and how that might link. And what I show in the book is that a lot of these beliefs that probably hung around in the area after the demise of Kara-Hentepe in about 8,000 BC, I think eventually end up at this place called Haran, and also the nearby city of Edessa, which is Urfa or Şanlıurfa as it is today, just a few miles away from Göbekli Tepe. And Haran was the clearing house, I think, for Gnostic beliefs, particularly to do with Orphism, which comes from the word serpent. I mean, they believed that, their god was in the form of a serpent, basically, and that it was almost a demiurge. We certainly know that a lot of Orphite cults would seem to have had strong connections with southeastern Anatolia, particularly one that I talk about in detail called the Peritae. And we know quite a lot about their rituals, more than virtually any other Orphite sect. And what they talk about is venerating a cosmic snake. But what's so interesting is that they talk about two cosmic snakes, the good serpent and the bad serpent. The good serpent they associate with the stars of Draco, which, obviously turn about the sort of the center point of the sky. But the bad serpent they associate with the whole area of Scorpius, Ophiuchus, and that. And they basically say to people, don't, no, that's the bad one. We don't go there now. You know what I mean? Where it's quite clear that it has an importance that's now been superseded by this much nicer serpent in the area of Draco. And I think that what's going on here is a memory of the significance of that area of the sky and the transfer of that information, quite literally in a story that I give in the book, from the area of galactic center all the way to the most northern part of the sky. But the other important thing about the Gnostic tradition, in similar with the Vedic tradition, is the belief of working with real serpents and snakes and allowing them to somehow enter inside them, not necessarily in a physical sense, but in a spiritual, magical, shamanic sense. And the idea of this, certainly from the Gnostic point of view, was to achieve some kind of, gnosis, a knowing and an understanding, not just of this cosmic snake, which they refer to as the sun, the god, the father was almost like this sort of supernal sun that existed outside of the physical universe, that was essentially it was beyond contact, but his representative was the sun. And of course, obviously this feeds into early Christian ideas of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, of course. And this is something that the Gnostics adapted, for their own beliefs, which were quite clearly much older than those of Christianity. And of course, we have similar ideas in the Vedic tradition of the Kundalini, the idea of allowing the Kundalini to achieve moksha, total understanding, possibly even control over, destiny. And we certainly know that these traditions also included the idea of gaining supernatural abilities and power. And what we see in so many statues at Taj Tepala are generally male individuals with their hands either on their navel or holding their private parts, basically. And of course, it's easy to say, oh, it's purely sexual or fertility, but I think it's far more than this. I think it's about saying, I have the power. I know that my power begins down here and rises up through my body, and I'm in control of it. I have the power. And I think that this is something that both in Vedic and in Gnostic tradition was prevalent, certainly in the past, and would have gone hand in hand with the idea of enlightenment, or knowing through gnosis or moksha or whatever.
Right. And that definitely then connects to the Eden story because the eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge. But what I wanted to point out is something also in Genesis, and this is just what came to mind when reading your book, especially that idea of the sun behind the sun. And the creation stories you mentioned, like the cosmic egg. And I know in the Enuma Elish, when Marduk kills Tiamat, he splits her in half. So one half becomes the earth and the other half becomes, it's the firmament, right? And the word Tiamat is in the very first, or a related word is in Genesis 1. And it's, I'm just
True.
going to quote here.
Tihan, isn't it? Tihon?
Yeah, it's Tehom, it's the deep. And so I was thinking about this image that you are giving of the serpent, the dark rift, the sun behind the sun. And in the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void and darkness covered the face of the deep. And to me, that's like, wow, there's a
Well, I
different
mean,
parallel.
what you've got here is obviously a sort of Christianized or and Hebrew version of the idea that initially there was nothing other than what most religions refer to as the cosmic ocean, which also was known as the primeval chaos or the void, if you like. And it was seen literally as a sea, but a cosmic sea. And out of this emerges, either the first land or obviously the egg emerges within it. And within the Yazidi religion of which is an indigenous religion of the Near East and Anatolia to this day, that the belief was that, a pearl came into existence within the cosmic ocean that then splits in part, and creates the world and the heavens in exactly the same way. And they also, by the way, believed in a world encircling snake, which I think is one of the terms that you can use for this cosmic snake or Milky Way snake. So, this is it. And the most famous pillar on in at Göbekli Tepe is Pillar 43, otherwise known as the Vulture Stone. And people got some alternative, let's say, ideas on, oh, it's all to do with cataclysms and whatever. No. I mean, to me, that does a great injustice to the beliefs of these people, which I think are deeply cosmological, cosmogonic in nature. You have a huge vulture representing a psychopomp. It's got a head in the form of a ball on the wing. It's clearly acting in its role of taking a person from this world to the next. And directly above it are three what people call ha man bags or handbags. And, people say, oh, it's obviously to put their drugs in, their hallucinogens. These are not handbags. These are three worlds, the three worlds that was universal throughout the Eurasian continent, and of course in the Americas as well, the sky world, the middle world, and the lower world. And on Pillar 43, each one has its own little creature connected with it. The sky world has a flamingo. Why flamingo? Because it would be seen to be within the waters of the cosmic ocean, on the shores between the two. In the middle world, you have a leopard because that can leap between worlds. On the right-hand side for the lower world, you have a toad or frog, a universal symbol of the underworld. So you have these are the three worlds, and around it, you have all these chevrons, which are very clearly water, and there's a bridge of stones right the way across them, going from the head of the vulture to the head of a huge flamingo that's there, that clearly symbolizes once again this transition from one world to the next. It's all about this, the transmigration of the soul, the idea of it going from one world to the next, to the next, to the next. Again, universal principles of shamanism that you find in Siberia or Mongolia to this day, or if you ask various Native American tribes, they'll tell you the same.
Yeah, it's fascinating the connections, and what seems to connect everything is the sky.
Well, it's the sky, but in the concept of the three worlds, the sky
Right.
is simply like the handle of those man bags, basically.
Right.
That's what's shown. The handle of the so-called man bags are simply the skies in each of those worlds. And the term worlds is probably not a good term. Realms is a better term. The three realms, the sky realm, the middle realm, and that. So in other words, they all seem to be similar but different. In other words, the sky world probably has its own sky. The underworld has its own sky as well. That's what those handles are. They're not handles of handbags, in my opinion.
So I know we're almost out of time here, unfortunately, but there are still continuous excavations at Karhon Tepe, correct?
I mean, they can't dig fast enough, but Karahan Tepe, I mean, they're uncovering so much so quickly that I'm sure some will say, oh, slow down, you might miss something. But no, they're doing it meticulously. It's the good work of Dr. Necmi Karal of the University of Istanbul. And at Göbekli Tepe, they did down tools for quite a few years, saying that they were going to leave it for a few generations because, in the generation to come, the techniques of archaeology will be better. That's a fair statement, but the trouble is, we want to know what's going on. This is our heritage, our human heritage here. This is not just, some domestic site from the Bronze Age or something. This will tell us who we are and where we came from, possibly, and help us direct us into the future. And so things have changed at Göbekli over the last couple of years. They've restarted clearing out the existing enclosures in what they call the Southeastern Depression. And apparently next year they're going to be opening brand new areas. So, all good, basically.
Yeah, my understanding is that there are things that are buried all over that area.
Yeah, there are. Yeah, I mean, officially there are 12 so-called Taş Tepela sites. By the way, that term Taş means stone and Tepela means hills. And it refers to the fact that they worked in stone, particularly to create these stone circles. And the Tepela, or the Tepes, are these occupational mounds which they build within. And we're obviously, taking them apart like a layer cake to see all this activity today. So it's Taş Tepela. There are officially 12 sites, of which at this time, probably about four or five are being excavated. The rest are either waiting to be excavated or have been so. But there are estimates that suggest there could be as many as 40 of these sites. And one archaeologist has even said there could be 100. And these are all in the same region. That's the thing. I mean, all right, the further you get away from southeastern Anatolia, you find that you're dealing with probably the same culture, but they're not creating these T pillars anymore. They might have pillars, they might have carvings, but it's beginning to change, shift. So you have to ask yourself, why are all of these T pillar sites all in exactly the same area? Why did they not spread out more? And why were they created in almost exactly the same design for 1500 years from around 9600 to 8000 BC? And then suddenly they just stop and the people go off and do their own thing, probably bringing that Neolithic revolution to other parts of the ancient world. So there's a mystery here. And myself, colleague, Hugh Newman, JJ Ainsworth, and obviously Graham Hancock, we want to know what's going on here. It's been, for me, a mystery that's gone on, not just in the 20 years that I've been going to these sites, but as I said, I wrote about them before they were even found. I mean, when I was writing From the Ashes of Angels in 1996, the first spades were going into the ground at Göbekli Tepe, but I would not get to hear about it for 4 years until it was in this huge color spread in a German magazine. And obviously, when I saw that, it was guys, there you go. Well, there's your mother lode. Here's your evidence of this advanced culture that gave the local people of the region, the rudiments of civilization. So, it's there. There's no question about that. Klaus Schmidt saw them, or certainly saw their ancestors, as the Anunnaki. I think he's correct. And I think that those prime movers did come from as far east as Siberia, Mongolia. And more information is coming up every year to suggest that there was contact between Siberia, Mongolia, and Anatolia. This is brand new stuff, which is, about to come out now, that gives us the opportunity to say, yes, the people in Southeast Anatolia did definitely have contact, communication with cultures going on there. And of course, then we have to ask ourselves, well, what was going on in Siberia and Mongolia? And that's obviously what you're reading the book, not only in that one, but other books like the Denisovan Origins, Cygnus Key, Origins of the Gods. And, I think a lot of it's to do with our distant cousins, the Denisovans, that were over that way.
Well, thank you for that. I know that we are out of time. So let me ask you the final question is, what do you have coming up next, and where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
Well, andrewcollins.com will take you to various articles. It will show you all the tours that we've got coming up. We do Turkey twice a year, in May and September. So the details are there. We're going to Peru, Bolivia, and Easter Island next November. We're just about to leave to Egypt now, actually. But yeah, I mean, if you're interested in all this stuff, there's loads of articles linked within the website. The book is obviously available from any good online bookstore. And yeah, I mean, if you have something to say which you can add to what I'm saying, please contact me. My email address is there on the website, plus all my social media. So, follow me on all of these.
Okay, wonderful. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for your time today. It was a very interesting conversation, and I really enjoyed the book, and it
Thank you.
prompted a lot of food for thought. So I appreciate
Well,
that.
thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you, and you have a wonderful day.
Cheers.
Or
All the
evening for
best.
you, actually.
Yeah, well, quite. Okay, all the best to you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. And that's a wrap on episode 175 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. Now, I know you know what's coming up next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family, and on social media too, please. And subscribe to the podcast or follow it on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. I know you know the drill. But the thing is, all that is really important. Sharing, subscribing, or following, they're all free and they only take a second of your time. And they really do help. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the front range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, psychedelics and consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.